It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, berry picking season is almost here, meaning we could start using fresh fruit again in our baking on Food Friday. We'll talk to a Madison baker about some of his favorite summertime desserts. First, there's been an increase in homicides, especially related to gun violence in the last couple years, after a big decline in that kind of violence from a peak back in the 1990s. A lot of that is driven by violence in cities. When we talk about solutions to urban violence, we often talk about root causes: poverty, lack of social mobility, economic and racial inequality. Or we talk about things like drugs and the challenges of law enforcement. Our next guest says those are important factors in the long run, but he says there are more direct, proven interventions that can turn the tide on urban violence more quickly and make it easier to tackle some of those long-term problems, too. We're talking now about urban violence, especially gun violence, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your loved ones or your neighborhood been affected by urban violence? Do you have a story to share? How do you think policymakers should address urban violence, which overwhelmingly affects poor people of color? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Thomas Apt is a senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice and author of the book Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. Thomas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
We've seen this uptick in urban violence in a number of cities across the U.S. this year. First of all, can we define the phrase, the kind of violence you're focusing on? What do we mean by the phrase urban violence?
Sure. When we're talking about urban violence, we also call it sort of community violence, or, it's the sort of intersection of gang, gun, youth, street violence. And each one of those terms sort of emphasizes a different aspect. But this type of violence is the violence that occurs between and among mostly young men without a lot of opportunity or many options. And so these are young men who are among the most disenfranchised in our society, and they mostly live in poor communities of color in our nation's cities.
And you use a metaphor for urban violence of a person bleeding from a gunshot wound in the emergency room when it comes to how we prioritize treatment. Can you share that with us?
Absolutely. It's very well understood that high rates of crime and violence are the unfortunate legacy of decades, if not centuries, of racial segregation, persecution, disinvestment, and other things. And so there are structural factors at play here. But at the same time, everything we know about the science of violence reduction says you have to address it directly. And so in the book, I have this metaphor of a young man who has been shot and is literally bleeding out on an emergency room operating table. And my point is that to save the young man's life, you don't get him a GED, you don't find him a steady job, and you don't deal with his housing. You do the first, most immediate, most urgent thing, which is you stop the bleeding so that you can save the young man's life. And that's the metaphor that I believe we need to, that's the same urgency with which we need to address the issue of urban violence in our nation's cities. We need to address it directly.
How do we do that? What is the equivalent in that metaphor of that surgical intervention? What is that direct intervention that's going to help stop gun violence without having to solve all the long-term causes first?
Sure. As difficult and chronic and persistent as the phenomenon of urban gun violence is, there is some good news in this area, which is that the phenomenon of gun violence is extremely concentrated. It's very sticky. It clusters together among a surprisingly small number of people, places, and behaviors. In any given city, there's a small network of individuals who are at the highest risk for gun violence, and that's a fraction of 1% of the city's population. And at the same time, we also know that, 4 to 5 to 6% of city blocks are going to generate 60 to 70 to 80% of the most deadly violence. And so the key thing to understand is that you need to have a hyper-concentrated approach to this issue and not stigmatize whole neighborhoods or whole classes of people. You need to really be quite focused.
Talking to Thomas Apt, author of Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. You can join in with your comments or questions for our guest about urban violence and how to prevent it at 800-642-1234. Let's start with the people most likely to be involved in violence. How do we identify them in a way that isn't, you know, a broad approach that, as you say, is stereotyping a bunch of people? And then how do we reach out to them to prevent them getting involved in escalating violence?
Absolutely. Well, you know, the first thing is that the people who are involved and are at the highest risk for either being a perpetrator of gun violence or a victim, because in this world of gun violence, today's victim is tomorrow's perpetrator and vice versa. It's not hard to identify these individuals. They're well known to law enforcement. They're well known to their own communities. And they've been involved in the criminal justice system and in the juvenile justice system for most of their lives. Many of them have multiple felony records. They've often been violently injured and shot multiple times in the past. And so this isn't sort of a needle in the haystack phenomenon. These are people who are persistently engaged and trapped in these cycles. And so identifying them is not hard, but helping them get out of these deeply entrenched sort of habits and behaviors is really challenging, because these are young men and sometimes not so young men who are really in crisis. You know, the science says that, yes, we have to make sure that they understand that they have to be accountable for the dangers that they pose to the community. But we also have to give these young men an alternative, something to say yes to. We have to provide them with some stability, offers of treatment to help them change the way they think and change their patterns, and then ultimately opportunities.
Do you have examples in mind of communities that have done this kind of approach and seen good results?
Sure. One of the best examples is in the city of Oakland. Many of your listeners might know that Oakland has been one of the most violent cities in the United States for decades. And it also has a particularly difficult history of police-community relationships. The Black Panthers were created in Oakland in response to police violence. And so Oakland is a very difficult place to operate and to make good policy work. But almost 10 years ago, the city launched this effort called Operation Ceasefire. And Operation Ceasefire, or Oakland Ceasefire, is a focused deterrent strategy, a strategy that's been used around the country. And the strategy essentially creates a partnership between police, community members, and service providers. And this partnership then identifies the individuals and the groups at the highest risk for violence, and then engages them directly and speaks to them. And they basically offer a very simple message. They say, the violence is unacceptable and it has to stop. If you'll let us, we'll help you. But if you make us, we'll stop you. And they combine this approach of both empathy and accountability. And they offer services and supports and assistance. But for those who persist in violence, there's targeted enforcement and prosecution.
Let's bring on a caller. Go ahead.
And I should just give the results. The results of this program in Oakland were approximately 50% reduction in gun violence over the span of 6 years. And this strategy has been effective in other places as well. The key question is not whether we can be successful. The question is, can we sustain that success?
Bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tomas is with us in Madison. Tomas, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. Given that there are generally understood to be equal rates of drug use between communities of color and the white community, and the disproportionate jailing and arrest of people of color, how much violence, strife in those communities of color can be attributed to over-policing, as well as the problematic culture of police departments that have been pretty well documented infiltration of those departments by white supremacists.
Tomas, thanks for the call. Some of that connects to what you were saying about Oakland and lack of trust given the history of the police department there. What do you think of Thomas's point, Thomas?
I think it's an interesting point. I think that clearly the police play an important role in violence reduction, and when they don't play that role effectively, violence can increase. I think that, and also I think there's an important question sort of underneath what Tomas said, which is the underlying legitimacy of law enforcement. And when people don't believe in their law enforcement, they simply don't use it. And so what the research shows is that when people don't trust their local law enforcement, they don't call 911, they don't serve as jurors, and they won't offer information. And that can lead all of those simmering conflicts in a neighborhood, which might be resolved nonviolently by resorting to the police, sometimes those rivalries escalate and turn violent. And so one thing you can see is controlling for other factors. Communities that have very low levels of trust in the police are generally more violent than others.
Tomas, thanks for the call. We're talking about gun violence in American cities with Thomas Apt, author of the book Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the ideas you've heard from our guests so far, the results of the programs that he's talked about in Oakland and elsewhere? Do you live in a neighborhood that's dealing with a gun violence problem? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Thomas Apt, senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice, author of Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. He says there are proven targeted interventions that can focus on the people and places most at risk of gun violence if we're willing to stick with it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have questions or maybe an experience to share, that's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Thomas, you mentioned a key part of this with any solution, sustainability. And I know I've talked to people who have worked with groups, violence interrupting and things like that, that seem to have found promising early results and then budgets get leveled out or cut. What does it take once you find an effective solution like this to make sure that the people who spend the money stick with it?
Well, it's a really interesting and difficult political challenge. One thing you see in many cities, and it's documented in my book, is successful strategies to control community violence, driving violence down, having significant success. But then once violence returns to a sort of acceptable lower rate, then the commitment leaves and politicians have other priorities, people leave, funding wanes, and then the violence goes back up. And so one of the key questions is how can we stop this back and forth where we where violence escalates, we temporarily do what is necessary to reduce violence, but then as soon as violence goes down, we ease up, we lose our commitment, and then the cycle starts all over again.
Is it hard to sell this kind of nuanced approach? Because there are a lot of really easy to formulate ideas out there on how to fix this problem, whether it's more police and more arrests, fewer guns in communities, things like that. Is it hard to go to a policymaker who might have some kind of partisan pressure from one side or another and sell these kind of ideas?
It is. The simplest way I can summarize the research, and my colleagues and I have summarized or synthesized over 1,400 individual impact evaluations, on reducing violence. The simplest way that I can summarize it is that successful anti-violence strategies have three qualities. They're focused, meaning they focus on the highest risk people and places. They're balanced in that they offer both carrots and sticks. They include both enforcement and prevention. And finally, that they're fair, meaning that they're perceived to be legitimate by the impacted individuals and impacted communities that they work with. Those are the three key qualities. But it's very hard to push through the sound bites on this issue. These strategies are not particularly conservative. They're not particularly progressive. So they don't really fit in either political party's sort of readily accessible toolbox. Also, they're a little bit more complicated to explain than just get all the guns off the street or give everybody jobs, those sort of soundbite types of answers. And finally, I think we have to acknowledge the role of race. This type of community violence impacts the most disenfranchised people in our society. And if this violence was impacting another segment of the population, I think there would be more political will to address it. And you can see this in the way the gun violence debate is distorted. We spend an enormous amount of time, energy, and attention on mass shootings. And mass shootings are undeniably important, but they cause a fraction of the deaths that are caused by urban violence.
Talking to Thomas Apt, author of the book Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. You've mentioned, Thomas, the importance of community involvement in these programs. It'd be easy for a police agency or a local government or violence researchers, say, to show up with the plan that's going to solve everything. How important is it to have the affected community be at the table?
I believe it's essential, and I think that the research backs that up. Ultimately, you can impose a short-term solution on a community, but if you're going to have success over the long run, you really need community members fully at the table, fully participating. And that means they need to be engaged from the beginning and be involved in the policymaking process. Now, I don't believe that it's fair to sort of ask community members to sort of make up a solution, out of whole cloth. But I do believe that you need to go to the community, present them with a series of options and say, here's a few options. They're backed by science. We think they could possibly work. Which of these options do you think would work best in this community? And how would you customize these options? I think that's the way you start the conversation.
When it comes to selling some of these ideas to people who are maybe aren't now part of that community, getting back to the person outside of the most affected areas who may be wondering, why should I care? You spell out the human costs in your book and your other work. Can you also talk about the financial costs of the kinds of violence we're talking about?
Sure. You know, these strategies don't cost a lot of money. So it's not like we have to mobilize a massive movement in society to get support for them. If we get enough people, a small group of people lobbying for these, they can get the funds necessary to do these things. How do we reach those people? Sometimes you reach them through their heads, and sometimes you reach them through their hearts. In terms of their heads and the dollars involved, the sort of most credible estimates suggest that society pays anywhere between $10 and $19 million in total cost per homicide. And that's not just the direct costs of incarceration, court costs, law enforcement costs, medical costs, but it's also the cost of all the fear and avoidance caused by violence in society. That translates into increased insurance premiums, higher taxes, and very importantly, diminished property values.
That brings things back around to our starting point to some extent on the longer term root causes of violence. Does making these neighborhoods most affected by gun violence safer, is that going to help tackle problems like poverty and some of those other root cause issues?
I think it's a great question. Many people talk about how there are root causes to this violence and things like poverty, inequality and lack of opportunity. And that is absolutely correct. But what not enough people talk about is that that same relationship exists in reverse, meaning that high rates of violence are actually perpetuating poverty, inequality, and lack of opportunity in these neighborhoods. And one of the ways this happens is through the deeply traumatic impact of being exposed to violence. And you can see this most clearly with kids. Kids, study after study shows that when kids are exposed to violence, either as victims or as witnesses, it traumatizes them and it impacts their ability to sleep, to focus, to behave, and to learn. And what happens to children who can never escape this violence because they live in a violent context in a violence neighborhood? Well, ultimately, it translates to significantly diminished academic performance, which ultimately impacts their ability to get a good job. High rates of urban violence are literally trapping poor kids in poverty, and it's important to recognize that.
I want to take just our last minute. I believe you've had your eye on budget proposals from the Biden administration when it comes to crime and criminal justice issues. Are you seeing attention to the sorts of things you say we need to see in our cities?
Yes, I'm quite pleased to see the Biden administration, as part of the American Jobs Plan, including $5 billion with a B dollars for community-based, evidence-based violence reduction programs, programs that have a history of effectively driving homicides and other forms of gun violence down. That is a remarkable level of investment that we've never seen before. But we have to remember that this is just a proposal. Congress still has to pass this plan. And as we all know, or as many people know, this is going to be negotiated over. And so we don't know that $5 billion will actually end up in any legislation. So we need to keep the pressure on Congress. But I am encouraged that the administration is taking this issue seriously.
Thomas, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Thomas Apt, senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice, author of the book Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll talk about some great ways to use seasonal fruit, including fresh berries, in our baking. And you can join in with some of your suggestions, too. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 8 on The Morning Show, there's recycling for a lot of household products, but how about e-cycling? Find out how to recycle electronic products in Wisconsin and what happens to our electronic stuff in the recycling process. That's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now it's Food Friday. This week we're baking with berries and other seasonal fruit. Berry picking season is starting up here in Wisconsin. Whether you pick them yourself or get them at the farmer's market or store, using fresh fruit gives a little something extra to our favorite baked desserts. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What is your go-to thing to bake when berries are back in season? Do you have a favorite summer fruit to use in your baking? Berries, peaches, something else? Do you have the rhubarb out? I know it's not technically a fruit. I bake with it like it's a fruit. Maybe you do too. Call 800-642-1234, or maybe you have a question for our guest baker, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sean Bolduc is a baker and owner of The Baked Lab in Madison. You can find him at thebakedlab.com. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
Well, berry picking season, like I said, is coming up. My rhubarb's still looking good and I think is still edible. Is there something seasonal fruit-wise that you really look forward to in the summer?
Oh, I am a huge blueberry fan. You know, once those blueberries start growing, I want to use them in everything.
What are some of your favorite everythings to use your blueberries in?
I mean, come on. A blueberry pie is like the perfect quintessential summer treat. Delicious flaky pie dough stuffed with some blueberries. I absolutely love mixing some herbs into my pies. Rosemary and blueberry go perfectly together. So I am like ready for the blueberries to start showing up this summer.
Okay, now that's interesting. I would not on my own devices have thought of mixing rosemary with blueberry. Could you talk about that fruity and savory combination? Why does that work?
Yeah, you know, I think that herbs, and they're all grown outside from the ground, and they just have something that works really well together. I love pairing rosemary with fruits like blueberries. I also love like strawberry and basil, lemon and thyme. There's just something about those flavors together. It kind of heightens the fruit and brings out some of the more natural flavors, and then gives it a little bit of a twist that you're not used to in your normal pie.
Now, you mentioned pies, but you also sent us a recipe. We've got at WPR.org/Food Friday for maybe the star of our fruit baking today and this summer, the galette. I've never made a galette. Give the basics. What is a galette?
Absolutely. So a galette is basically just a free form pie, right? So a lot of people have trouble or get really nervous when they get in the kitchen and they're starting to roll out a pie dough and they've got to somehow get it inside of a pie tin, make the edges of it look beautiful with crimping and all of that kind of stuff. But the galette is just a free form pie. So basically I'm making a standard pie dough, dropping something into the center of it, and I'm kind of folding over the edges right on top of itself, baking it off in the oven. And it's just as delicious as a standard pie, but less fuss.
You had me at not rolling it out because you know, I have some cooking skills and I have some baking skills. Rolling out dough is not among them. For some reason, I am just constitutionally incapable of doing that well. So I really like that. Now, we're talking fruits. You gave us a recipe for peach and plum galette. Talk about that combo in our galette. Sounds really good to me.
Absolutely. Peach, plum. Sometimes I add raspberry in there. Galettes are really great with stone fruits. So a lot of times you can just kind of chop up that fruit. Mix it up with a little bit of sugar, maybe add a little bit of cornstarch for the thickener, and then drop it right into the center of your pie dough, bake it off. I think they're delicious. And there are so many different ways that you can enhance a pie like that. The peach is one of my other favorite summer fruits. So why not throw it into a galette? Maybe add a little bit of bourbon, and it's absolutely delicious.
Now, in a note card you sent over to us, We can make that dessert galette, but once we know what we're doing with our galetting, we could do anything with it, right? We could do other pie type ingredients. We could do savory. The sky's the limit.
Absolutely. I think one of the best things about a galette is that it's really just an open invitation for anything you've got in your kitchen. You know, on a savory note, I absolutely love putting tomatoes into a galette, heirloom tomatoes mixed with a little bit of cheese. Drop it right into the oven. Again, you've got both a delicious dinner, and then you can make another one with your peach and plum on the side, and you've got a galette, a whole galette dinner with dinner and dessert.
I'm in. We're talking to Sean Bolduc on this edition of Food Friday. He's a baker, owner of the Baked Lab in Madison. We're baking with seasonal fruit right now. That could mean berries for you, could mean rhubarb. You could be looking ahead to other fruits coming along the way. You could share your favorites and or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you want to jump into Galette Fever 2021, you can go to WPR.org/Food Friday, find a recipe for your basic galette. 800-642-1234, again, is the number. Sean, I think we're getting a little late in the rhubarb season, but I've got this monster rhubarb plant in my backyard that came with the house, really, and it's still there. Favorite ways to use rhubarb?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the typical strawberry rhubarb pie, rhubarb and strawberry bars is another delicious way to do it. Another thing that a lot of people don't think about, but you could actually cook down some rhubarb over the stove and make either like a nice jam that you could pour over some fresh or some ice cream. There are just so many different ways that you can both use rhubarb and fruit together. I like that little tart bite of the rhubarb mixed with a nice sweet strawberry. Absolutely.
Okay, now you had a savory herb to go with all them other fruits. Is there one that can go with rhubarb? You got me really curious about this now.
I actually think that rosemary, I think rosemary pairs really well with anything that has sugar in it. I think rosemary has a really delicious flavor. I often will make simple syrups using herbs. So those can go in, you know, in soda water and all of that kind of stuff later in the, or throughout the summer. So sometimes I'll make like a compote of blueberries or strawberries and then mix a little, simple syrup with rosemary in it and drop it into some club soda. And it makes a delicious, cocktail or non-alcoholic drink for the summer.
Now, getting back to baking with our fruit, I know it's easy, and I've experienced this myself, making a pie or whatever dessert. If you're using fruit in it, it can be easy for me to make it too runny and watery, and then the dough gets soggy, and it's still edible, but it's not perfect. How do we make sure we don't swamp our baked goods?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's something in the baking world called blind baking our dough, right? Have you ever heard of that?
I think I have, and I think I've even done it, though I forgot it was called that.
Yeah, so that's when we make our dough, we put it into a pie tin, and then we bake it in the oven, maybe with some beans inside of it to kind of help hold its shape. That helps the crust get a little bit of a little cooked and set before we add our runny fruits to it. So that's one great way to prevent what's often called the soggy bottom of our pies. The other thing to do is, you know, one of the things that I like to use is frozen fruit on occasion with pies. Adding a little bit more of your thickener, so maybe cornstarch, will help soak up some of that extra liquid and help prevent a pie from getting really soggy bottom.
That sounds pretty good. Okay, yeah, I have done both of those techniques. I just didn't know what they were called. So that's pretty good news. We're talking to Sean Bolduc, owner of the Baked Lab in Madison. He's our guest for this edition of Food Friday. We're talking about baking with berries and with other seasonal fruits that are coming down the pipeline. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something you look forward to baking when summer fruit is back in season? Is berry picking a tradition for you? What are your favorite ways to bake with whatever you pick? Do you freeze some for the future? Do you do rhubarb? Do you do the big berries like strawberries, blueberries, raspberries? Do you get go to service berries or other ones that you might not see in stores all the time? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Sean Bolduc, owner of the Baked Lab, talking about some good ways to use fresh berries and other seasonal fruit of the coming summer in our baking. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite fruit to bake with? Do you like getting it at the farmer's market? Do you pick it yourself at a farm? Do you forage something that you like to bake with? What is your all-time favorite? Or do you need some advice for a favorite dessert or a new experiment? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you ran into some trouble with our phone lines earlier, I believe we have that fixed now. So give it a try, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sean, we heard on Facebook from Cassandra, who says berries are some of the healthiest foods you can eat as they're low in calories but high in fiber, vitamin C, and antioxidants. And that reminds me, I'm a big fan of those things that live on the borderline between dessert and breakfast because it's got some oats in it, maybe. It's got some fruit. I don't mind eating that for breakfast. Do you have favorites that that live in that magical borderland?
Ooh, I love a granola, so something that you can bake off in the oven with just a mixture of all different types of things and dry out some fruit in there. I know that dehydrators have become like a huge phenomenon in the home kitchen recently, and it's always fun to kind of put some fresh fruit that you've picked into a dehydrator and let them dry out, and then maybe add them to a mixture of oats and maybe even chocolate and put it over some Greek yogurt in the morning. That sounds delicious to me.
All right, we've talked about pies and galettes and now some breakfast. I don't want to leave the cake people out of the equation. And I know you do a lot of cake making with different frosting and decorations. Bring some fruit onto our cakes, please.
Absolutely. I tend to use fruits either in things like curds in the center of my cakes as a filling, or even sometimes I mix it into a buttercream and kind of up the flavor of the buttercream itself. I am not personally a huge baker of fruit inside of my cakes themselves, but that doesn't mean that you can't. A fresh coffee cake with blueberries baked into it sounds fantastic to me. I have a great tip for that. You know, you can definitely use frozen fruit in your cakes and in your muffins. What I would highly suggest is we all run into that issue where we bake off our muffins in the oven or our cake in the oven, and we pull it out and we find that all of our fruit sank to the bottom. Have you ever had that issue?
Yes, definitely, especially with muffins.
Right, right. One of my easy tips for that is I always toss my fruit in a little bit of flour before I add it and mix it into my batter. That will, again, sort of do a similar situation like we talked about earlier, where it'll soak up some of that excess liquid that is expelled once it comes into contact with all that heat, and help sort of let them float in the middle of our baked good.
Intriguing. And that really works.
Absolutely. I think that's like one of the tips from any pro baker out there will tell you to toss that fruit in a little flour.
Excellent. I love it. I will give that a try next time. Now, I promised one of our producers, I think this was Dean, said he is a big fan of your Swiss roll with raspberry and mascarpone whipped cream. He's made this himself, though intriguingly never brought it in for his coworkers to eat. So, you know, whatever. But tell us about this one, because he's a big fan.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the Swiss roll is generally a sponge cake that's baked in on a sheet tray. So it's pretty thin and it's flexible enough that we can kind of roll it up with stuff inside of it. I love to use fresh jams and whatnot within a Swiss roll. So this particular one is just a vanilla cake that we add some fresh, in this recipe, we added some raspberry jam to the center. And then basically I whip up some whipped cream, I fold in some mascarpone cheese, and then I spread it into the center and roll it up. And it's like the easiest, most impressive dessert you can bring to a gathering this summer.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Monona. Karen, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to ask about, Karen?
I thought she was good. Okay. Well, the first thing is, when you mix this pie crust, does that mean you make the pie crust and then you make the beer mix and then you fold them all together going back and forth and back and forth and then you throw it into the pie tin? If that is so, do you need to do something on the bottom of the pie tin or the glass to keep the berry juice from burning?
Oh, interesting. Oh, thanks for the call, Karen. Yeah, good question.
Yeah, that is a great question. It shouldn't really burn, because if you're putting it between, or if you're putting the pie dough between both your tin and the berries shouldn't burn themselves. One of the things that I like to do when I'm baking off a pie that I don't blind bake, which means I don't bake off the pie a little bit in advance before I add the fruit filling, I like to preheat my oven with a sheet pan towards the bottom half of the oven. So when I put my pie inside of the oven, it gets that direct heat underneath it very quickly and helps sort of seal everything into the pie dough.
Excellent. Hope that helps, Karen. Thanks for calling in. We'll go to Justin now in Waukesha. Justin, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you had any good ideas for a dessert flatbread or a dessert pizza. The restaurant I work in just launched a s'mores flatbread, and it turned out wonderful.
That sounds great. What are you using for the bread itself? Are you making your own, or like using a naan bread or something like that?
We just use a naan bread.
Okay, that's NAAN, like the Indian flatbread. S'mores pizza. You had me at s'mores pizza. Have you done anything like this, Sean? A dessert flatbread.
That sounds absolutely delicious. I have not actually done anything dessert wise with like naan or any of that type of bread. But this would be a great opportunity to use that pie dough in a galette type of situation. You know, something that I really like about the galette is that I can make it any shape that I want it. So in that case, I could make it sort of long, like a like a long flatbread pizza and then chop it up into slices for my guests. So you could easily do any type of fruit in there. And I bet it would be absolutely delicious too.
Justin, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. It is Food Friday. We're talking to Sean Bolduc, baker and owner of the Baked Lab in Madison. We're talking about baking with seasonal fruit, berries, and beyond. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite baked fruit-related dessert to share with us or a question for Sean, 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Okay, Sean, here's one that I have never tackled myself. I believe it's probably beyond my capabilities. Those fancy fruit tarts you see sometimes at the fancy bakeries, are they hard to make?
No, I think they're pretty straightforward. You know, usually in those types of tarts, we're using more of a sweet pastry dough. So it's a little different than our standard pie dough, where it's more like a cookie. It's more like a sugar cookie pie crust. And then usually they're filled with a pastry cream. Pastry cream can be a little intimidating to some people because you're cooking a custard over the stove and you have that chance of running into scrambling your eggs. I always tell people low and slow while you're cooking that pastry cream. And then the best part about it is that you get to decorate the top with whatever type of berries or fruit that you want. And it becomes an art project at that point.
Now, when you're in search of fruit ingredients, I don't know, you're a busy baker. Do you have time to go out and pick your own, or do you at the farmer's markets? Like, where do you go to get the fresh stuff when it's in season?
Oh gosh, I don't know the last time that I went and picked my own fruit. I will say I grew up in Massachusetts, and there were several blueberry bushes and strawberry fields right next to my parents' house, and that was amazing to get to go pick those fresh things. But now I'm a huge fan of the farmers markets. We have so many here in the Madison area, and I can just support my local farmers by going out and grabbing their fresh produce.
Do you ever work with some of the less mainstream berries? Like, I have a service berry tree in our yard, and I found out when we did a show on berries a while back, a lot of people like these service berries. I just found out they were edible last year. Do you get into those, or mulberries, or some of the things that are maybe harder to package up and sell in a store?
You know, I have to tell you, I have not actually ventured into that all that much, so I wish I had more to share there, but I don't.
Okay. Well, that's fine because I don't have a lot of ideas either. But Sean, it's going to be a hot weekend. Is there something we can put together that's going to give us that feel of a fruity dessert without having to spend a lot of time with that oven on a 90-degree day?
Absolutely. I am a huge fan of the icebox cake. Have you ever made one of those?
I have not. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So an icebox cake is basically a whipped cream type cake that we put into the freezer for a little while so it gets nice and solid. I actually don't use specifically ice cream in this type of cake, but what I like to do is I like to cook down a compote of something like blueberries or strawberries, and then I basically layer it in a tin, something like a bread tin with plastic kind of in there, so I'm pouring it into the plastic. So when it sets, I've got layers of something like fresh whipped cream. You could even fold in the mascarpone to that whipped cream, fresh whipped cream, some berry compote, and then oftentimes I'll add something like a vanilla wafer or a graham cracker, and it stays away from the oven. There's no actual baking happening, and it's a delicious treat for a hot day like tomorrow and Sunday.
Maybe I will try that. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Sean Bolduc is a baker and owner of the Baked Lab in Madison. He joined us for this Food Friday to talk about how to bake with fresh berries and other seasonal fruit on the way this summer. Coming up Monday on Central Time, geometry doesn't just happen in math class. It actually shapes the world around us. We're going to find out why with the Wisconsin author of the new book, Shape. It's Jordan Ellenberg, UW mathematician. And he finds the patterns and, yes, shapes in the world around us that come up in surprising ways. That and more Monday on Central Time. Regular listeners know that I'm a big fan of board games. So when producer Bill Martins showed me this new survey of board game-related behavior, I was definitely interested. The game company Z-Man commissioned a survey that asked people about arguments that break out over board games, whether they had ever actually banned a particular game among their family and friends. A lot of people, it turns out, have done that. The most commonly banned game, according to this survey, Monopoly. No big surprise there. A lot of people own Monopoly, and it's all about bankrupting your friends and loved ones, leading presumably to these arguments. I have one piece of advice that might help. I'm not big into Monopoly, haven't played it in a long time. There are a lot of other really good board games out there I'd rather play. But if you're going to play it, please do me a favor, do yourself a favor. Don't do the thing where you get money when you land on free parking. That's a house rule, not a real rule. It's bad. Because, one, it makes the game longer and more argument-prone. The game ends when all but one player is bankrupt. Free parking injects extra money in the game, so it pushes back that ending condition. Two, it's a big random element in a game that already has a lot of randomness. Three, it doesn't make any sense. I'm happy in the real world when I can park for free, sure, but I've never come back to my parked car and found $100 bills under my windshield wiper. Doesn't make sense. This is Central Time.